She has a voice of complete thrilling drama.
Shirley's over the top, but it's a sincere over the top.
You'd say, hey, you wouldn't wander on and sing a couple. I won't, she said. I'll sing three or four.
She's a massive diamond. She's Shirley Bassey.
There really is nothing like a dame, especially one who drags herself up by the bootstraps from a tough childhood in post-war Wales to become an international superstar, singing for presidents, kings and queens, adored by millions around the globe as perhaps the greatest interpreter of epic songs on any stage, the biggest voice of the 007 films, the biggest voice full stop, and possibly the most down-to-earth diva in the world. As she would say herself, this is my life. I'm Paul Sexton. Welcome to part one of Bassey. In this four-part series, we'll be hearing about the life and times of Dame Shirley Bassey from the lady herself. In an exclusive new interview for Radio 2, I've been talking to the Tigress of Tiger Bay about an incredible career of 5.5 decades. We'll also be hearing from the people who've known Shirley and worked with her throughout a unique lifetime as an entertainer. People like classic songwriters Don Black and John Barry, Goldfinger star Shirley Eaton, Jimmy Tarbuck, Des O'Connor, Chris Rea, and the stars who've written songs for the new Bassey album, The Performance, including Gary Barlow from Take That, Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys, Nick Hodgson of Kaiser Chiefs, Tom Baxter, and Richard Hawley. When the album comes out next month, it will undoubtedly extend Shirley Bassey's lifespan as a UK chart artist to an eye-popping 52 years. We have a preview from the album tonight and more later in the series. In fact, our story will conclude as part of Radio 2's very special Bassey Night later this month. More about that next week. But as soon as we sat down, Dame Shirley told me how she feels about the new record.
I'm ecstatic. I never thought it would turn out this way. I mean, it's more than I ever dared hoped it would be. You know, 11 fantastic songs written for me by 11 different writers. I don't know, it's a different voice. There's parts of my voice that I never used before. You know, like the head voice. And this quiet, calm. Because everybody associates me with belting, Goldfinger, you know. And it's more or less true. But my vocal coach that I had this head voice and I had this lovely softness, but I never used it. And she said, I should. And on this album, it came out. So those writers knew what they were writing about. They brought it out of me. I hope I've done them justice.
There's a crack in every pavement. Underneath, there is a beach. It's been a long time longing as history repeats. Yes, man.
That will be on the new Shirley Bassey album, and talk about custom written for her. It is called The Girl from Tiger Bay, and it's composed by her fellow countryman, Manic Street Preachers.
Well, I bought a ticket to the Lifetime. That's very autobiographical. Mm. Would you stop shooting these words?
Sorry. It's about you.
It's about me, yes.
How was that to sing? I mean, how did you feel when you saw that lyric for the first time?
Very emotional. I didn't think I'd be able to do it because I felt, no, it's too personal. But then they're all personal. They're all autobiographical. I said it. But there's something about Tiger Bay, though, naturally, because I'm from Tiger Bay, and that is terribly personal.
So the Dame has made lots of new musical acquaintances through the new record, but she also has lots of friends who've known her right through her incredible journey. And one of her closest mates, here reminding us just how close, is another much-loved British showbiz staple, Des O'Connor.
We have been friends, I would say, for a lifetime, and literally mean for a lifetime. I actually... although she told everybody on Audience With about this, which was supposed to be our secret, I dated her. I took her out. Well, only on the one date. And in the middle of the, you know, the Audience With, and I insisted at that time that there were genuine questions and I didn't want to know what they were going to be. And so she comes out, only Shirley could do this. She said, do you remember the times you took me out on dates? So I said, well, hang on, the S bit, we went on one date. She said, yes, we went on one date. And she told the audience about how I took her for a row on the lake, which I did. It was up in Leeds. And then I took her for a... she was joking. She said, took me for to see a film in Radio Rental's window. And then she has a wonderful sense of humour. And she said, and then after you came to see my concert, and then after that, you took me to my hotel. We went up to the room and stood outside my door. Then you kissed me on the cheek and you left. So everybody was laughing in the audience. This is the 10 million viewers she's telling everybody. Then she said, I said, well, what did you think? She said, I thought you were gay. And only Shirley could say it that way. It's so wonderful. She's got a great sense of fun. In fact, she dropped me in it again because she was a guest on my TV show, Medicine. She was always welcome to sit on that couch as well as sing as she does. I said, well, this has been fun tonight. I said, we must do it again sometime. She said, why bother? We didn't do it last time. That's the Shirley problem that the public don't know. Yeah. This wonderful, bubbly sense of fun. Yeah, I have known her a long, long time.
She's a very private person. The Dame is not a fan of celebrity for its own sake, doesn't like to do chat shows, seldom talks about herself at length. So with this rare opportunity, we'll try to find out what drives her, what makes her tick. You'll certainly hear the playful sense of humour she's always had. And this evening, we'll learn about those early years, singing to keep from crying, finding a voice that steered her away from her dreamed career and into working men's clubs, getting discovered, being banned by the BBC, and having her first hit when she was just a few weeks out of her teens. But as for the new record, well, she didn't really expect to be making it at all.
I really retired, to tell you the truth, you know, and I was just coming out for special occasions. Yeah.
Like the best china.
Yes. Yes. And these writers have brought me back, you know. They brought me out of retirement.
The nerve.
And how dare they, yeah. But it was something, only that could have done it, you know, and it was a challenge, and it worked, it paid off.
And we'll have lots more about the performance when the Shirley Bassey story comes back to the future towards the end of the series. Henry Bassey, a merchant seaman from Nigeria, and his English wife Eliza Jane were settled in Tiger Bay in the working-class Docklands of Cardiff and already had six children when Shirley Veronica arrived on January the 8th, 1937, the day Elvis Aaron Presley turned two, incidentally. Money was tight and Shirley was noisy.
Well, my mother said I could sing before I could walk. You know? And I must say, if I was upset as a kid, I used to sing instead of cry. A weird kid. I was a weird kid.
But it's... what was the general view of that in the family?
Oh, Mum, Shirley's singing again. I'm trying to sleep. Shut her up. And until, of course, I made it. And then suddenly, that's my sister. They yeah. didn't shout at me anymore.
But it was, you're obviously a big family.
Yeah, I was the youngest of seven.
Yeah.
I was the baby. And so it was a shock to everybody when I suddenly, you know, sort of became known for my singing. you know, and I became famous, and they couldn't believe it. And actually, the thing we used to tell her to shut up and, you know, and complain about her.
What was Tiger Bay like at that time? It was pretty poor, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Well, we left when I was about 5. It was very tough. I think that's why my mother wanted us out of there.
Did you go to somewhere more, you know, that was kind of a little bit more conducive?
Oh, yes, and much more quiet. But it was an all-white area, you know, but we didn't have any trouble at all. We all lived quite happily together, and I had a lot of friends. But I was still a loner. Don't ask me how I got into singing and why. I mean, I never wanted to be a singer. I wanted to be a model. I wanted to wear fabulous clothes because I only ever had hand-me-downs, you know. and then I wanted to be in the shoe shop. Then I wanted to be an air hostess, and then until they told me I had to have 2 languages. And I said, is Welsh considered? No.
Two others. And then the voice just took over. I mean, the singing just took over. So.
Yes, it's like a big tidal wave came in and caught me, and I've been on that wave ever since. It's like I've had no say in it. It was meant to be. You know, it was my destiny.
So some of those early sort of public performances were in, what, like local pubs and clubs, weren't they?
Well, I was discovered, yeah, in a workman's club. And as I was only 15 at the time, I could only go at a weekend because that's when the wives were allowed to come to the club. So Saturdays and Sundays I sang, and I was discovered in one of these clubs.
Shirley had left school at 15. Her first day job when she wasn't singing in those clubs at the weekend was at a local factory wrapping up enamelware for export. And even then, on the shop floor, she would sing her head off. She's always said she didn't find singing as a career. It found her. Here's Des O'Connor again.
Shirley, I wouldn't say she was deprived or underprivileged, but certainly from an area like that, you've got to prove and what you can do and live your dreams. She obviously was a gifted girl. I mean, that voice, it's extraordinary. Although I tell you an interesting thing, Paul. Not that long ago, it would be about 7, 8 years ago, when she was on doing one of the Des O'Connor Tonights, and we're sitting there, and then afterwards, I came up and I said, your voice, she'd just done Hey Jude, which she blasts, you know, unbelievable. I said, your voice seems to be getting stronger and better. And she said, I'm having singing lessons. And she'd be, I won't give her age, but she was a mature lady there, singing lessons, which shows that she's always wanted to improve, always wanted to do that and go that one step further.
At 16 years of age, Shirley took a role in a local musical based on the life of a great American entertainer who'd only died 3 years before. It was called Memories of Jolson.
Oh, you beautiful doll, you great big beautiful doll.
Shirley later laughed at the idea that she was asked to play a cotton picker in a show about slavery put on by Brits and touring the English provinces. But it led to another show, Hot from Harlem, in which she was booked by the promoter Joe Collins, father of Joan and Jackie. At just 17, Shirley Bassey had to face controversy for the first time, and not the last, when she had an illegitimate child, her daughter Sharon. Well, you can imagine the moral outrage, especially in small-town Wales, but she braved the scandal and has never named the father. Partly because of the pregnancy, Shirley got to thinking that she wasn't cut out for show business, and she went back home to a waitressing job while her mother, Eliza, helped look after the baby. But in 1955, everything changed when Shirley was spotted by a booking agent from South London called Michael Sullivan. He put her back on the road and into a show at the Adelphi Theatre on the Strand in London called Such Is Life, starring the radio comic Al Reed.
Our Maggie's going to get married. She's made up her mind to get wed. Her bottom drawer's bulging so much it's divulging the quilt that she bought for the bed. It's well known she's not one for rushing. Well, she's 90 when all's said and done. And somebody's told her if she gets much older, she's going to miss most of the fun.
Johnny France spotted the Welsh teenager in the Al Reed show. He was a big noise in records at the time as a producer and A&R man at Philips Records. In 1956, he signed her, and Shirley Bassey released her first single, More Controversy.
Who's got a match you're striking? Don't say it all depends. Who wants to help me burn my candle? At both ends. is hiding under a bushel, friends. Who wants to help me burn my candle at both ends?
They banned my Who Wants to Help Me Burn My Candle, boom, boom, at both ends. I was, what, 18, 19 at the time, you know. I had no idea, you know, what I was singing about. And then, of course, when it was banned, I wanted to know why it was banned. And then it was explained to me. And I never sang the song the same again. You know, I think I took it out. And there's me thinking it was a real candle.
At both ends, who doesn't mind the reaper? He sung wild oats. Who wants to take a chance and help me burn my boat? Who's not a look then leaper? Won't hit a warning note. Who wants to take a chance and help me burn my boat? It's possible the pace may prove too hot.
Burn My Candle didn't make the official UK singles chart, but the other side of it hinted at the teenage Bessie's potential as a singer of big, torchy numbers.
Don't know why. Keeps raining all the time.
The song was older than Shirley was, but it was a bold attempt at stormy weather. And her first hit was just around the corner. In February 1957, rock and roll was making its presence felt in the UK charts with Elvis, Little Richard and Bill Haley. The crooners were going well, Pat Boone, Frankie Vaughan, Tab Hunter and so on. But Calypso was making a bit of a surge as well, and just before rival versions by Harry Belafonte and the Terriers, which would also become hits, Shirley Bassey got in there first with the Banana Boat song. It was number 8 in the UK at the end of March 57. Shirley's hit career was up and running, and the glamour, well, the die was cast.
She was appearing at the Leeds Grand. I was at the Palace, Halifax. So it was Premiership and Third Division, really. Nothing wrong with Halifax, but I was a boy learning my trade. And she said to me, because she was for a week now, and I was a week at the other theatre, and she said, I need some clothes. You want to come with me? And I thought, that's all I need. Go around. I said, where are we going? She said, CNA's. See, I thought we were going to go to the Queen's dress designer. CNA's? So we go to CNA's, and we walk around the store, and I've never forgotten this, and you can ask her this. She bought a white pencil skirt. You know, you can hardly walk in it. You know, so don't ask me how I know that. And she got a black blouse. And I think she actually wore that on stage, and it cost £20 or £21, something like that.
My first gown was thrown together. I had a Merry Widow. I was one of the first who wore it outside rather than underneath. And I borrowed a lilac net skirt from one of the girls in the show and an elastic belt from another. And that was my gown. And then I made the mistake of throwing my arms up at the end of the song and the elastic belt came off. And the skirt started to... Whoops! Yeah. I learned from that. I thought, no, you're going to have gowns that are engineer on you, you know, sort of like a building that will not collapse.
Scaffolding.
Scaffolding, yes. And now the audience, you know, they look forward to seeing what I'm wearing. And they write to me, what are you going to wear? And so the gowns became as famous as the songs. The gown had to be sensational. And that's how it built up, because the audience was expecting that, you know. And mustn't let them down, except when my luggage went missing and with all my gowns.
Oh, no.
And I borrowed something from a hotel boutique, and it was a fringe thing. And I walked on in, and there was silence. The audience knew this was not one of my gowns. So I had to explain to them that my gowns went to Vegas and I'm in New York.
And we'll follow Shirley's travels to all those exciting touring destinations in next week's programme. Banana Boat Song was followed by a couple of more modest hits with Fire Down Below and You, You, Romeo. And then came a double assault on the charts that produced two massive records, simultaneously in the UK top three early in 1959. From the Pet Shop Boys, Bassy Fan and now a co-writer for her with Chris Lowe on that upcoming album we mentioned, Neil Tennant.
One of her first hits is very double entendre-y. Is it Kiss Me, Honey, Honey, Kiss Me? I saw her, Chris and I and some friends went to see her in concert in the 90s. And she did that at the Royal Festival Hall, and that was one of the songs she performed. And I was amazed how flirtatious it was.
Kiss me, honey. Closer now. Closer now.
Shirley's longtime friend, the great lyricist, Don Black.
She is such an incredible performer. I've always been a fan of hers. I mean, I've known her since the Denmark Street days in Timpan Alley in the late 50s, early 60s. I remember Kiss Me, Honey, Honey, Kiss Me. And I remember her walking down Charing Cross Road with her first husband, Kenneth Hume, who was managing her. One thing about her, she's never changed. She has always had that star quality. There's always been something about Shirley that is a kind of a remoteness, a distance, something that you get with great stars like a Judy Garland or Sammy Davis or Sinatra. There's something untouchable about Shirley, and that's what's kept her right at the top for all these years.
I will love you as I love you all my life. Every moment spent with you makes me more content with you. Just as you are, you are all I could pray for.
As I Love You, written by the American team of Jay Livingston and Ray Evans, who also wrote Whatever Will Be for Doris Day. The jazz singer Carmen McRae had released an unsuccessful version of As I Love You in Britain. Shirley's wasn't a hit first time around either, and they'd actually moved on to the release of Kiss Me, Honey, Honey, Kiss Me, but then Phillips re-promoted As I Love You, hence the two hits at the same time, and that was LaBassie's first number one song for 4 weeks in February and March of 1959. In part two of our story next week, our Shirl conquers stages nationally and internationally, sings for an American president, and delivers perhaps the most famous James Bond theme of them all. And we'll hear from another of her great friends in the world of light entertainment, Jimmy Tarbuck, from John Barry, and from 007's original Golden Girl. Last contribution this evening from a much-loved 50s rocker who's still very much with us today, agreeing with Don Black that our star always had certain standards and a certain detachment about her. This is Joe Brown.
With someone with a voice like Shirley, I think it's a lot to do with production, you know, picking the right songs for her. You tend to go through your life, you forget what you mean to people and you forget it yourself. But then someone comes on and say, but, you know, I've always wanted you to hear you sing this kind of song and come up with a good song that Shirley loves and that he knows is going to be a monster hit. And she's had some wonderful songs as well. This is the deal, isn't it? And which she's treated with great respect.
So, I mean, people use that word diva a hell of a lot, and sometimes they use it in a bad way, but I think, I mean, it can be quite a good word. I mean, she, you know, I don't know, if she is a diva, then it's a good diva, I think.
I don't know, but I don't know what a diva is, really, I suppose it's... I suppose she is a diva, yeah, yeah. What would they call a bloke, then? A dover.
Bassie is written and produced by me, Paul Sexton, at Wise Buddha for BBC Radio 2.
In 1934, a former skating rink was transformed into what would become one of the most famous recording venues. And